Genesis chapter 23. We saw in our last study, Genesis 22, how Abraham was severely tested as he went to Mount Moriah and had his Moriah moment. That is, in chapter 22, the test that Abraham went through was in the offering up of his son. He was ready to plunge a knife through the chest of Isaac to do what the Lord told him to. Take your son, your only son, unto the mountain that I will show thee of, and there offer him as a sacrifice unto me. And we studied that chapter at length in our Sunday services. So if you were here Wednesday or Thursday of last, but weren't here on Sunday, then to get the story, maybe you'll want to pick up the tape because we looked at the whole chapter in our Sunday study. But be that as it may, he was tested in chapter 22 in a big time way, in the offering up of his son. But now, in chapter 23, the test intensifies really. For you see, in chapter 22, he was offering up his son, but in chapter 23, he is letting go of his wife. And I believe that in chapter 23, it would prove to be, perhaps, a more severe test for Abraham than what transpired in 22. Offering up his son, 22, letting go of his wife, 23. For in 23, we will see the death and the burial of Sarah. Why do I say that it's a more intense trial? Because when a child is taken on into eternity, when a child is taken on to heaven, that is, without question, a very real heavy-duty trial. And Abraham was faced with that trial there on Mount Moriah. But the fact of the matter is had he had to go through with that act, which he didn't, you know the story, but had he gone through with it, he would still find consolation and he would still find comfort in the presence of his wonderful woman, his wife, Sarah. When a child is taken to heaven, oh, it is a difficult time without question. And yet, you can look to your spouse and lean on your spouse and draw from your spouse, and the two of you can stand together in those times. Encourage each other. But when a spouse is taken to heaven, it's a trial that is, in my experience, even more intense. For you see, at that time when you desperately need your spouse, she or he is not there. And the nights can be oh so long and the days can be oh so dark because the person that you desperately want to talk to and the one who you can really be open with and the one who has been there previously at the time when you need that person more than ever, they're not there. And that creates some real unique difficulties. If you have seen a spouse go to heaven, you know that very real drama, that very real dilemma. The very person that you would normally lean on and cry with and look to, that human partner, they're not there. And so you look at your family, your kids, and you find yourself, man, I wish that my mate was here to help me navigate through this treacherous time. Whenever a loved one is taken, oh, don't misunderstand me, there's challenges and difficulties, but in my experience, I have found that as difficult as it is to see a child taken to heaven, it really doesn't compare in some ways with when a spouse is taken on. Both are difficult. And that is why I think here in chapter 23, it would be an even greater trial for Abraham. It's not usually viewed that way. But Abraham, you see, had a remarkable woman that he was married to, a woman that he loved very much, a woman that is held up in the New Testament as a paradigm or a picture for what a godly Christian wife should be. He would miss her greatly. Now in this story, chapter 23, we're going to see the story divide itself into three movements, three sections. The first movement deals with Abraham's grief, verses 1 through 6. Abraham's grief at the leaving of his wife moving on to her eternal destination. And then the second movement is Sarah's grave, verses 7, 8, and 9. So you have Abraham's grief, 1 through 6. You have Sarah's grave, 7 through 9. And then you have Ephron's gift, verses 10 through 20. Grief, grave, and gift. Interesting, because after my first wife was taken to heaven in 1982, 6 days or 5 days actually after her homecoming, it was Sunday morning and I addressed the fellowship and gave the morning teaching, and this was the text that I preached from. And so this text has much meaning to me personally. And when I came back around through the Bible again, as I came to chapter 23 this last time through, which was a number of years ago, I found myself unable to teach from the text. And so I just commented on verse 1 and was unable to just really articulate and communicate, as there was too much feeling in it for me. And so I just went on to chapter 24. So I haven't taught through this text in many, many years, except for last night. But the text, I think, has all kinds of practical insight for you who will, if you have not already, dealt with the very real trial of the departure of a loved one, of one that's close to you, one you're linked with. This is an interesting chapter for me, because it has a lot of practical application that was very, very illuminated or very, very impacting in those days immediately following my wife Terry's homecoming to heaven. I think that it would be wise for you, for me, for all of us to think through this passage. It's not a waste of space spending a chapter on a funeral situation, because the fact of the matter is this: the statistics on death are incredible. 10 out of 10 people die. And it's really kind of sobering. It's true, and it's going to be affecting you, loved ones, family members. Unless the rapture happens, which I'm really hoping for and I would be real glad about. But all of us will see people that we're closely linked to departing, or else we will depart, and the ones we're closely linked to will have to deal with these issues as we move on into eternity. So this is not wasted space. It deals with an issue that every single one of us will deal with or go through at some time or another. So let's take a look and see Abraham's grief, first of all. Sarah was 7 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And she died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham stood up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the children of Heth answered Abraham, saying unto him, Hear us, my lord, thou art a mighty prince among us. In the choice of our sepulchres bury thy dead. None of us shall withhold from thee his sepulchre, but that thou mayest bury thy dead. In other words, wherever you want to bury her would be fine with us. Sarah. Did you know Sarah is the only woman in the entire Bible whose age is given? Now, when you read the scriptures over and over, time after time, you'll get the age of men in genealogies, in stories, all over the place. Men's ages are given constantly. But women's ages are not revealed in the scriptures, except right here in this one situation. Why is that? Well, it could be because the Holy Spirit is a gentleman. And you know that women tend to be a little bit reticent about revealing their age, like the little boy that gets on the bus and his mommy is following right behind him. And those that are five or under, they get to ride free. So as the boy makes his way up and his mom is following right behind, the bus driver looks at the little guy and says, How old are you, sonny? And he says, I'm five, and my mom is 47. And the mother, of course, didn't appreciate that so much. Women tend to not want to readily reveal their age. One young guy I heard about, he was in a real pickle. An attractive, middle-aged widow said to this younger man, I bet you have no idea how old I am. And he looked at her and said, Well, ma'am, he says, I do have an idea. Oh, she says, coyly, tell me. He says, Well, I don't know whether to say 10 years younger than my idea because of your attractiveness, or 10 years older because of your wisdom and intelligence. A good answer. That was Bill Clinton. But no. No. That's a good answer. A man who knows how to deal with women in that way. So why is her age revealed here? What's the deal? She's 127. Hey, it's not to embarrass nor to expose, but it's to exalt. That is. This woman, 127 years of age, she was an incredible lady. Why, when she was in her 80s, she was so physically attractive and so beautiful that Abimelech, the king of Gerar, looked at her and said, I want her to be in my harem. And, you know, those kings in those days, they were very, very picky about the women that were allowed to be in their harems. They could have any woman in the region. But when he saw Sarah, even when she was in her late 80s, he was smitten by her and impressed with her and drawn to her and said, Hey, I want her to be in my harem. So Sarah here is a remarkable woman. She was preserved miraculously. She would be proud of her age being revealed because she would look more like she was, you know. I better watch this very carefully. She would just look like she was at the perfect age that women look. So she wouldn't be embarrassed about this a bit, you see. A remarkable lady, and now she's 127, and she, though, like all people, she moves into eternity. And she dies. And Abraham, we are told at that time, he was in an area called Hebron with his wife, in the land of Canaan. How illuminating that phrase is. Abraham and Sarah, when Sarah was taken on into eternity, they were in the area of Hebron. It's not accidental nor incidental that that is given to us. For you see, the name Hebron, as many of you know, literally means in the Hebrew, fellowship. That's what the name Hebron means. In other words, Sarah died in fellowship. She was in fellowship with her husband. They traveled together. Oh, they had some challenges, and we've looked at those in our previous studies. But man, they worked it out and they stayed by each other's side. And they found themselves in fellowship the day that Sarah died. She was in fellowship with her husband. She was in fellowship with her Lord, a godly woman, whom, as I said previously, Peter says, that's the kind of woman that a Christian wife should be. Peter says, study her. Look at her. Learn from her. That's the kind of woman that a Christian wife ought to be, like Sarah. In fellowship with her husband, in fellowship with her Lord. It's a great thing when a person moves on into eternity, being in fellowship. I think of when my first wife, Terry, was taken to heaven. Sunday night, before the Monday morning in which she was taken on into eternity, she was up on stage leading worship, and the meeting was really, really special. It was a Sunday night deal, and if you've been around here Sunday nights, you know that, man, those can be the richest times in our fellowship week in many ways. And she was leading worship that evening, and we stayed up late that night and talked about the blessings that we were enjoying in the fellowship and what God was doing at that time. And what a wonderful thing that the next morning we got up and we're going skiing to Mount Bachelor when my car hit ice and the Lord took her home. But I know that she was truly walking closely with the Lord. She was in fellowship. I think of my daughter Jessica, who the last thing she did before she was taken to heaven, she was here, and you've heard me tell the story many times, but she was here in the sanctuary that morning, having communion, offering prayer. And she walked out the door, and a few minutes later, she was in heaven. What a fabulous thing that my daughter Jessie didn't die at some high school party where drinking was going on, or some wasted spot, some dumb thing. I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to know that those that were linked to me intimately died in Hebron, died in fellowship. Here, Abraham sees his wife depart on into eternity in Hebron. It's illustrative of the way it ought to be. Yet, we read, even though that is so, Sarah died in Hebron. Abraham, verse 2, came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Even though Abraham was a giant of a man, called the friend of God, the father of faith, even though his stature was spectacular spiritually, yet we see here that Abraham was a man who mourned and wept. Bible students, you that take notes on these things, you that are interested in the Word in this kind of a way, make note of this. This is the first mention of weeping or tears in the Bible. God waits until chapter 23 to introduce this concept. And if you've been traveling with us in Bible study, you know the principle of first mention is a real key in understanding the biblical flow of revelation. And it's curious to me that God does not introduce weeping or tears in the biblical account at the fall of man. It doesn't say that Adam wept or that Eve wept or when the flood came. It doesn't say that Noah wept or when the Tower of Babel was built and the people were scattered. It doesn't say that tears fell. The Holy Spirit purposefully waits till this moment to introduce that truth. Weeping, tears would happen at a moment when a godly woman was taken to heaven and was separated from a giant of a spiritual man. This is important because there can be those that say, hey, if you're godly, or if your partner or child or whoever died in fellowship in Hebron, so to speak, suck it up, shake it off, and there's no need to shed a tear. Well, God would say in this passage to you and me, it's more than okay to weep at such a time. Abraham did, and the Holy Spirit writes it here. This is what this godly man did when his godly woman was taken. This godly man, even though it was in Hebron, in fellowship, there were tears flowing. The Hebrew word speaks not of a quiet cry, but a real sobbing. This is important because crying is part of the plan, part of the process. God understands. Why, God himself wept at a tomb, didn't he? In John chapter 11, right around verse 35 or so, Jesus, God in the flesh, was there at the tomb of a friend named Lazarus, and that shortest verse in the Bible that many people know, Jesus wept. Oh yeah, I'm a Bible memorization student. Yes, Jesus wept. Most people know that verse. It's two words long. But it's significant because it was there at the tomb that Jesus wept. In fact, in the book of Psalms, I'll read it to you. It's a great little nugget tucked away in Psalm 56. Listen, O God, thou tellest my wanderings. Put thou my tears into thy bottle. Are they not in thy book? Lord, you know my wanderings. You know the journey I've been on. Lord, you put my tears into a bottle. They're written in your book. Did you know God keeps scrapbooks, evidently, in heaven? One of those scrapbooks, Malachi chapter 3, says that every time one of his children talks to another person about him, about God, that God hearkens to it and writes it in a book. Oh yeah, those guys at Applegate there on Thursday evening, they were talking about me, and he writes it. Perhaps you've heard Gail Irwin's little vignette on K-Apple about that. I like it. It's true. God writes whenever you, whenever I, whenever we talk about him, he listens in and he writes it down. There's a scrapbook he's keeping, but there's another book he's keeping that also is the book of our tears. He keeps our tears in a bottle. He doesn't say, hey, deal with it. He says, I understand and I treasure the thing that you're going through. It's saved. It's precious to me. If you go to Israel and you go into any of the antiquity shops, you can actually buy for $100 or so what they used to keep in Jesus' day. The women all had what they call tear bottles, little bottles that would fit right here against your cheek, and your tears would flow into this bottle, and you would save your tears in these little bottles. So when the woman came and washed Jesus' feet with her tears, it would very likely be that she had her tear bottle with her, and she was pouring out her tears that were saved over many years, perhaps. And it would be a very important possession for a woman to have this bottle of tears. And she would give that bottle of tears to the one whom she loved the most. Interesting, because as I've mentioned before, tears are unique. You take a tear and look at it under a microscope. I have done this. And you'll see in a tear the saline crystals, the salt crystals, are shaped in the form of a cross. It's a real beautiful thing. It's as though the Lord would say, hey, I understand, I know, I wept that day at the tomb of Lazarus. I store your tears, the psalmist says to you and me. God stores our tears. He bottles them up. They're in a book. Abraham wept. But here's the thing. Here's the deal. Paul says this, I'll read it to you, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, concerning those that have died and gone on. Paul said in verse 13, I'll read it to you, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that you sorrow not as others which have no hope. Hey, hear this. I want you to be knowledgeable. I don't want you to be ignorant about those who are asleep, that you sorrow not as those who have no hope. And here's the deal. A Christian's tears at a funeral, a memorial service, it's a whole different gig than an unbeliever's tears. When I first moved up to Applegate, I wasn't here very many weeks until I got a phone call from a lady that was in despair. She was screaming, and somehow she got my number, and I jumped in my Volkswagen Bug. I had a Bug back then too, and drove down into Medford to the address that she gave me, and her son, her 16-year-old son, had put a shotgun in his mouth and blew his head off. And I was just a young rookie minister, and I walked into that room and I was horrified. His head was literally splattered all over the walls of his bedroom. And I was the first one there, and I still, it's a vivid memory to me to this day. And it was an amazing thing that happened, because this family, much of the family, had no real relationship with the Lord, no belief in the Lord. And the weeping that went on and the wailing that went on for days and weeks and months, I can recall doing this service, and the family insisted on an open casket service. It was a really strange thing. So when people came by the casket and looked in, the young man's, he had no head. His head was literally blown off. All you could see was his jaw, and this part was. And it was like the family in that case really desired for there to be this kind of intense mourning. And it just went on months and months and years and years. Tears, yes, but not the tears that we shed when one of ours goes on to heaven. Yes, we too, like Abraham, there will be tears. But it's not the tears of despair. Paul says, I don't want you ignorant about this thing called death, lest you sorrow like the world sorrows. Your sorrow is going to be a whole different thing. What's our sorrow? Our sorrow is based upon, man, we're going to miss them, but we're glad for them. It's a bittersweet kind of thing. Because we know that heaven, man, we're all going to be there. We're all headed in that direction, all of us that are believers. It's only a temporary separation. And those that have preceded us into heaven are having a ball. They're having a grand time. And yet, tears flow because of memories and rejoicing. It's a time of, oh man, we're going to miss them, but yet it's a bittersweet kind of thing. Now, I need to talk to you for a few moments here about something which over 20 years since that particular funeral that I did for that young man until this day, I've made some very, very definite conclusions and observations. Having been there myself and watched others go through the events, weeping at memorial services, at funerals, if that's what you wish to call them, is okay indeed. It's, I think, even commendable. And yet, the weeping is not the kind of inconsolable kind of weeping that the world has. It's a whole different thing. And yet, I have noticed that even Christians sometimes are inconsolable. And I observe this over the years. Many times at memorial service, when a child is taken to heaven or a loved one moves on into eternity, the tears are not bittersweet, but just bitter and hot. And they don't cease. And there seems to be no peace because of a tremendous amount of guilt. People that see a child, a loved one, a husband, a parent perhaps, if you're close in that way, move on into eternity, and you know that you did not share good times. A man confided to me not too long ago, a couple years back now, how he just can't forgive himself. Because when his wife was taken suddenly, he evaluated his story. And he realized that, not expecting his wife to be taken in that way, that he spent all of his time and energy on the material aspects. Getting a bigger house and a nicer car and all that. But they never had memories that were built together. Very, very few. He was working long hours, and every spare moment he had, it was building his material thing. Nothing wrong with houses, nothing wrong with cars. But man, he hated himself. And his heart was broken because he realized, I never made memories with my spouse. It was all about getting ready for something. We never got there. And I guess part of what the Lord has scripted for my life, you know, Jimmy gave a great message a few weeks back about how the Lord is the author and perfecter of our faith and life and how He writes the script. And one of the things that the Lord has scripted for my life is to be a reminder to you and to others that, man, you don't know. This could be the last time that you'll be with that child of yours or that husband that you're sitting next to. You do not know what lies right around the next bend. And I really believe that that's part of what I am to do. I am to be a living reminder and a verbal vocalizer to people saying, look, you think that son is always going to be there. Don't count on that. You think that my husband is always going to be beside me. You don't know that. And how I pray and hope that during that memorial service that will come your way, that the tears will be those, yes, we miss them. We shared such memories. We had such good discussions and good times. Yeah, there were challenges and there were setbacks. But man, we built memories together. In my case, as I look back, I am so thankful that there were books, volumes of books, of memories, of photographs done both with Terry and then later on with Jessie, my daughter, of things that, quite frankly, you know, maybe others would say that's not practical. You shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't take the trip to Hawaii. You shouldn't take that trip to Europe. You shouldn't go skiing. You shouldn't do this because, my goodness, you know, you need to be, you know, you get a bigger house. Nothing wrong with big houses. I'm just saying, my goodness, what does it matter if you have a big house at the expense of making memories with your spouse, your child, your parents, whatever it might be? What does it matter? What matters is, did you really take the time to instruct your child in the things of God? Was there deep, meaningful discussions? Did you have time to enjoy the pleasure and presence of your husband or your wife? Or was it all about business and material stuff? And if that's the case, I tell you the truth, you'll regret it. There'll be tears of grief. You'll say, you know, what a bummer. We always meant to take that trip. We always meant to do that little thing. It doesn't have to be Europe. It might be Lithia Park, throwing a frisbee. It might be getting a Big Mac. Hey. But it's making your life, the relationship, rich and real and fun and eventful and memorable. It's looking back and saying, we really had terrific times. It wasn't all about just getting our financial house in order or our physical house built. If I could speak from my heart to you today, I would say, husbands, wives, moms, and dads, make sure you're making meaningful memories. Because life has a way of ending very, very unexpectedly. And many people look back and regret, we didn't really enjoy life, extract from life, or have real richness in life because we were preparing for retirement. Nothing wrong with preparing for retirement. If your daughter was taken to heaven tonight, honestly, whether she's 2 or 32, would you look back with tears of gratitude and say, I miss her, but we had richness in our relationship together. And she knew that I loved her. And I knew that she loved me. And things were maybe not perfect, but as right as I could possibly desire. Or your husband, or your wife, or whoever. Listen. Tears are allowable, commendable. Especially if, like in Abraham's case, there are tears that flowed in Hebron, in the place of fellowship, not the place of regret and remorse. And so Abraham mourned for Sarah and he wept for her. Abraham said in verse 4, I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you. So please, he says, give me a possession, a place where I can bury my dead out of my sight. Wow, there's some stuff in there to ponder. I'm a stranger and a sojourner. Abraham makes this statement when, after he sees Sarah moving on into eternity, he looks at those around him and he says, as the Holy Spirit records, this world is not my home. I'm a stranger and a sojourner. I'm a pilgrim. Something happens. And this is the wonderful side of death, if you would. That is when somebody that's close to you or a part of you departs. When that happens, life becomes a whole lot clearer. Things become very focused. You realize something that previously was theoretical or theological, but now becomes very real and very powerful. That is, you know what? I'm a sojourner here. I'm a stranger here. I don't look at this world as being my home. I'm passing through. Because Jesus would say to me and to you, wherever your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And when you begin to see treasure, family and loved ones, treasure deposited in heaven, your heart is there. And that's why this whole thing of the departure of loved ones is an important process in spiritual development. Because it's a way in which you suddenly wake up one day and say, my heart really is in heaven. Not that I don't enjoy life immensely, but I realize life is short, that we're all longing for that glorious grand time when there's no more tears, when they're all wiped away. And world's things, no matter how fun they might be, they don't last. And suddenly you find yourself being free. You really find yourself being free when somebody who's close to you moves on into eternity. It's a good thing. Because your treasure is there and you realize, like Abraham said that day, I'm a sojourner here. I'm a stranger. Here's the tricky deal for you Bible students. Abraham, in this area that he's in, guess what? This is all his property. Hundreds of thousands of square miles. He's right in the middle of his own property. But what does he say? It doesn't mean a thing to me. God gave him all of this land. But does he mention it? No. Does he act on it? No. Does he care about it? No. He simply says, I'm a stranger and a sojourner. And Abraham, you see, when his life ends, the only thing that he's going to own is Sarah's grave, the place he buried her. Even though God said, from the Euphrates River to the Nile, man, it's all yours, Abraham. Abraham would say, no. Not that he wasn't believing for what God said, but he was saying, really, I'm a pilgrim. I'm a stranger and I'm a sojourner here. And then he says this remarkable thing that I understand. He says, I don't belong here. He's not being a big baby. It's a moment of revelation. It's a moment of realization. I really am headed for heaven. We know that because in Hebrews 11, what does it say? Abraham looked for a city that has what? Foundations, whose builder and maker is God. I get it. I understand. I'm looking for something that is solid and has foundations, that's permanent, and it's not going to be found on this planet. How foolish is the man who lives for this world? It's the dumbest thing a person can do. I don't care if you're CEO of a Fortune 500 company. I don't care if you're Bill Gates. You're an idiot. Jesus said that literally, you're a foolish man. If you're making that your priority, if that's where your energy, time, treasures, and talent is going, because it's all going to pass away. It's amazing to me how dumb I can be. how I can begin to think, well, you know, my little empire on Hunter Lane, you know, it's going to be here forever and this is going to bring me happiness. Ridiculous and idiotic. Life, the Bible says, is a vapor. And when your spouse or your child, someone close to you, passes on, it suddenly becomes very real to you. What am I really doing? Abraham said, here's what I'm doing. I'm a sojourner. I'm a stranger. I'm passing through. I'm looking for a city, and I know where it's going to be found, heaven. That's where my time, treasure, talent is going. And so, what does he say? Let me bury my dead out of my sight. Interesting. Not make a monument to her. I want to bury her and continue on in the pilgrimage that God has ordained for me. Not that Sarah won't be a part of my heart, but I realize that, hey, we're going to be reunited one day, family and friends and loved ones. And I cannot be caught up or frozen in time. I must bury her, Abraham said that day, out of my sight. And I must continue on the pilgrimage that God has me on. That doesn't mean forget about her. It means that I realize that what's going to make the loved ones who have gone on ahead of me most happy is not to be mourning perpetually, but to be moving on to the finish line victoriously. Hebrews chapter 12 says, concerning those that have gone on, that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. If you have a loved one that's in heaven right now, you know what they're doing? They're not saying, please be sad. I really want you to be depressed and miserable. I want you to be mourning perpetually. No. Hebrews chapter 12 says, you are surrounded by those that have gone on. I am surrounded by those that have gone on. And they're saying, go for the finish line. Go for the gold. It's real. You'll be here before you know it. Before John's done, maybe, which is not an impossibility. Come on, go for the gold. Sprint. Be free. Hebrews 12 says that's what they're doing. They're cheering us on. They're not saying, please feel badly for another year. Or please be depressed for at least a decade. That will make me real happy. What are those that have gone on saying? They're saying, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. This is great. I can't wait till you get here. And I want you to come with a full reward. So bury my body out of your sight and press on. And join us with richness. I honestly believe I am doing a disservice to people that have gone on ahead of me. My dad, my first wife Terry, my daughter Jessie. I believe I'm doing a disservice to people that have gone on ahead of me. If I have not, like Abraham, made a decision to say I'm a sojourner, I'm a pilgrim, I know heaven is where I'm headed, and now I'm going to go for the gold. I would do them a disservice if I was caught in a perpetual obsession of depression. That would not make them happy. And I believe that this is really one of the key components of this passage. Abraham says, yes, I have mourned. Yes, I have wept. That's right. But now I'm a sojourner, I'm a stranger, and let me bury my dead out of my sight that I can press on with the calling that God has given to me. That's what's going to make those that have gone on most happy, most proud, if you would, without question. Now, one more. Verse 6, when Abraham said that, let me have a place to bury my dead out of my sight. They said, Hear us, my Lord. Thou art a mighty prince among us. Take any sepulcher you wish. Hey, we've got all these carved out tombs, you know, in the area right here. Take your pick. You're a mighty prince. This intrigues me because for you who have tendencies like I do to get engaged politically, listen, Abraham lived very, very, very simply in a tent, and he built an altar. We've looked at his story. He lived for eternity, and he had a huge impact on the heathen, the pagan, the cultures. They said, "You are a mighty prince." Whereas his nephew Lot really wanted to be involved in the cultural climate and situation of Sodom. He sat, where did Lot sit? In the gate, the place where the leader sat. And when Lot tried to correct them from that position, "Don't rate those angels," he said to the men of Sodom. "Don't rate my guests." They said, "Who are you? You've come amongst us and now you're sitting in the seat of leadership over us, but we don't acknowledge you. Get out of here," they said. They had no respect for Lot. They had huge respect for Abraham. This is an enigma, a mystery with huge implications, because you will hear this phrase, "Well, you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good." Let me tell you something. You're no earthly good until you are heavenly minded. The people who are really impacting in life, folks, listen carefully. They follow in the footsteps of Jesus. They live for heaven. And something happens. The heathen, the pagan, the Canaanite says to Abraham, "You're a mighty prince," when he could care less about that. He wasn't trying to maneuver or position himself amongst them. He was just living for heaven and loving God. And they said, "You are a mighty prince." Whereas Lot was trying to get into the inner workings. And they said, "Who are you, Lot?" Now, I'm not saying that we should not be engaged citizens. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be voting and interested in issues and participating in the process and holding office and what have you. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying this. In whatever you do, the focal point and priority and passion, if you do want to make a difference on earth, as ironic as this sounds, be a man, a woman, who lives for eternity. Whether you end up being the president of the United States or whether you are a whatever you might be on the other end of the spectrum. Of course, that might be whatever. No matter where you end up, you will make an impact and a difference if you are heavenly minded. This really intrigues me. That Jesus could care less about power plays and all that stuff. They wanted to get him involved in a huge controversy concerning taxation. "Master, should we pay taxes to Caesar?" That was the hot issue. All the ditto heads weighed in and all the liberals wanted more and everybody was involved. And it was a huge issue. And Jesus said, "Let me see a coin. Whose image is this?" "Caesar's." And give it to Caesar. The implication is, whose image are you? You're made in the image of God. Then that's what you should be living for. Wherever you work, whatever your lot is, whatever your position might be, hey, the ultimate answer is, you're living as an ambassador of the eternal kingdom. That's the whole deal. And that's the way you influence people. It's ironic. It's an enigma. You're a prince. You're a mighty prince among us. Well, quickly, and I will speed it up. Next, we see Sarah's grave. One comment here. Abraham, verse 7, stood up and bowed himself to the people, to the children of Heth. shows respect to them. Interesting. He said, if, verse 8, it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me to Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he hath, which is in the end of his field. I don't want any of your carved out tombs or sepulchres, but there is a cave that is owned by this man Ephron. Give me that cave because it's at Machpelah. I believe this is strategically placed. The name Machpelah means double doors. There's a way in and there's a way out. I want that place, the place that's called double doors, because you see, it's not the end of Sarah's life. Yea, the psalmist would say, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Not yea, though I'm left in the valley. There's a door in and there's a door out. That is, when I die, my last breath on earth will then become my first breath in heaven. It's a double door situation. I'm passing through. I want Machpelah. That's the place I want to bury Sarah. The place of double doors. And I think it's prophetic and I think it's poetic that Abraham would say, that's the place. Not your fancy tombs and sepulchres that you've prepared for years. I want that place called double doors because that's reality. We're passing through and we're moving on into heaven, you see. Well, number three, after Abraham's grief and Sarah's grave, Ephron's gift. Ephron or Ephron, depending on how you choose to pronounce his name, the name means fawn-like. Fawn-like. And Ephron comes on the scene, and what does he say? Well, Ephron dwelt, verse 10, amongst the children of Heth, and Ephron answered Abraham in the audience of all those that were listening, and he said, nay, my lord, verse 11, hear me, the field give I thee, the cave that is therein, I give it to thee, in the presence of the sons of my people, give I it to thee. Bury thy dead. Well, Abraham bowed down himself from before the people, and he spoke to Ephron in the audience of the people, saying, but if thou wilt give it, I pray thee, hear me. I will give thee money for the field. Take it of me. I will bury my dead there. So Ephron answered, saying, verse 15, my lord, hearken to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. But what is that between me and thee? Take it and bury thy dead is the implication. It's worth 400 shekels of silver, though. He gives the price. So Abraham hearkened to Ephron, and he weighed to Ephron the silver which he had named in the audience of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money, with the merchant. At first you would say, Ephron, whose name means fawn-like, you know, what a deer. He is so dear here. That would be the initial reading or the initial implication, what a deer. But upon closer inspection, you go, oh dear, what's going on here? See, Ephron's playing a game. What he's doing is what they still do in the Middle East to this day. If you've gone to Jerusalem, the old city, the bazaars, the Arab bazaars, oh my, they're called bazaars for a reason. I can recall a couple of years back going deep into the bowels of the bazaar, farther than I've ever gone before. Way back, I went through every nook and cranny and spent hours back there. And once you get away from where the tourists hang out and where the tourists do their thing, you see these amazing deals in the bowels of the bazaar. I mean, you go way back in and you're the only tourist there, you know, and you really feel it. And they sell, for example, one woman, you know, she had a great big basket full of cow's eyeballs. And they were just all stacked up and people were going through it and buying eyeballs and, you know, putting them in their little bags and amazing things you see, you know. It's really interesting, the aromas and the sights and all the rest. It's unlike anything that I've ever seen before. But anyway, when you go back into the bazaars or back into the Arab sections and do bartering with them, I can recall coming back out again to where more of the tourist thing was happening, and I saw a little chess set there. And I was interested. I said, well, now, how much is that chess set? And the owner there, the Arab owner, looked at me and he said, He says, for you, I give it to you. Now, suppose I would have said, oh, thanks, and grabbed it and walked away. I would have not lived another day, believe you me. See, he didn't really mean it. I give it to you. That was the beginning of a long process of negotiation. He didn't really mean, if I said, oh, thanks, buddy, and walked away without giving him shekels, my goodness, it would have been trouble for me. It would have been the end of me. See, and what's happening here with Ephron, he's saying, watch this. I mean, he goes, verse 11, I give it to thee, he says, in the ears of all those who are listening. Give I it thee. I give it to thee. Give I it unto... Three times in one sentence, he says, I'm giving this. Like he's really going out of his way to say, I am giving this to you. Which is very definitely a ploy to say, you know, this sounds good. It's polite. It's interesting, but it's worth 400 shekels of silver. That's the real price. Was it really? Well, Bible commentators say no. That was meant to be the negotiating starting point. Ephron would have probably been thinking, I'll get 100 shekels of silver out of this deal. Abraham says, fine. And he gives him 400 shekels of silver right there. He pays the full price. He pays the full price to Ephron. Ephron takes the money. It was a gift, but not really. There is strings attached. Kind of like when somebody gives you a gift, you know, and you open it up and the price tag's left on. And then you discover that they got it off the bargain shelf and the price tag was not nearly what they paid for it. But they're leaving it on to try and present an image. That's what's going on here, essentially. An image is being presented. Negotiations are initiated. But Abraham just says, hey, if you think that's what it's worth, fine. And he measured out the money that day. Interesting thing taking place here. There's a price to pay, and he knows that. Abraham understands it. There's a price to pay. There's a price to pay, but it needs to be paid. It needs to be done. And he weighs out to Ephron the 400 shekels of silver. Because he realizes that whatever Ephron is saying, I will give it to you free. It's not free. Not from the world. Not from Ephron. Like when Jonah, you know the story, he goes down to the dock, he's running away from God, and there's a ship there. Just happens to be right there, ready to take him away. And it says that Jonah went down into the boat and he paid the fare. How convenient. A ship is right there, but wait a minute, Jonah. You paid for it in more ways than one. And if you take what the world is offering you, as the world offered me, I got a person that came to me, truly, true story, and said, you know, we've been watching you, how you've been handling this situation. And we love you so much. And but we're convinced that you're not dealing with reality. And we have made arrangements for you, and we'll pick up the tab for therapy. And I appreciated the gesture. I mean, I appreciated the sentiment. But you know, there's a price to pay. In this particular situation, a person that went to that same counselor through that same what they call grief therapy, they had a chair there. And what you would do, this person was telling me, you talk to your person that has gone on to heaven, and you pour out your frustrations about perhaps the fact that you feel as though that they, you know, have you know, left you early, or whatever you're feeling, or whatever it might be. And you go through this whole talk through visualization kind of Christian counseling kind of therapy. And you know what, gang? Listen carefully to what I'm to say concerning this Ephron. I give it to you. I give it to you. Hey, it's your... No. I'm not taking it from you, Ephron. Because you represent the world and the world's way. And I have no intent or no desire to take what the world offers me as it relates to this event. You see, Jesus said in John 14:27, "Peace I give to you, not as the world gives." You can take it from Ephron if you wish to, but there's strings attached. What they're offering, what they say, "I give this, you, this will be a help to you, this is going to be great." Hey, I say, careful. There's strings attached. Even though they may be so sincere and so generous and so right in their heart, in reality, there's only one source of peace, and that is Christ Jesus. You say, "John, that's narrow. That's dogmatic." I have been there. I'm not talking to you about theories. I'm talking to you about where I have been. And I tell you the truth. There is a peace that passes understanding if you don't take what the world is trying to tell you and what the world is trying to sell you. Don't take Ephron's gift. Jesus Christ is the giver of peace, and he said it's a peace unlike what the world, quote, gives for 40, 50, 60 bucks an hour. It's a whole different thing. The Bible says it's a peace that passes understanding. Yes, Abraham, tears are flowing. Yes, certainly there's a season of mourning. But then there's this thing that takes place where you press on and you have peace, and people will say, "Well, you're just not dealing with reality." Well, it's been years and years and years. And continues. You know, my son Peter John is on his way home for a time because he's very, very sick. And, you know, I think about that when I talk on the phone to him, and his fevers just don't go away, and he's at 105 degrees yesterday. And he's delirious at night, and the guys are real worried about him. And so we have him on a plane coming home, and I know that, I understand, having walked through this thing before, that, you know, you have no guarantees what's around the next bend. You don't know. But this I do know. Whatever is around the next bend, the Lord is going to be there. He has proven to be absolutely faithful. Don't buy Ephron's trip, precious people. Don't go there. It might seem generous. It might seem like a good deal. Well, let's discover your inner child. Or let's explore who you might be in your caloric or sanguine disposition. Or maybe you're a blue or a yellow or whatever. Don't go there, folks. It's bogus. Jesus said, "I give you peace." It has nothing to do with your sanguine or caloric temperament or what color others say you are or what sign of the zodiac you were born under. It has nothing to do with any of that. That's Ephron stuff. What you say is, "Lord, you are the giver of peace. You're the Prince of Peace, and you promised that you would provide peace if I cast my care upon you, if I humble myself before you, if I spend time looking to you, that you would give me a peace." Jesus said, listen, Jesus said, "Let not your heart be troubled. In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also." He said, listen, let not your, which means I have a choice. I can let my heart be troubled, or I can let not my heart be troubled. It's a choice I make. I can say, well, everybody else is saying I should be in this deep depression, so I'll buy into Ephron's deal. Or I can say, but Jesus said to me, let not your heart be troubled. So I choose that way. I choose to be anxious for nothing, but in everything with prayer and thanksgiving, Let your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God, which passes understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Johnny, why are you saying this to us? Because I really care about you. And because I'm speaking from experience, and because I know what's going to happen. There'll be Ephrons that will come your way and try to get you sucked into all kinds of bogus stuff. And you've got to say, uh-uh. Jesus said, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives. Thanks, Ephron, but no thanks. No thanks. And he didn't take the bait, if you would. Interesting. We'll finish the last four verses quickly. Please bear with me. And the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, double doors before Mamre, the field, and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field that were all in the borders round about, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth before all that went in at the gate of his city. And after this, verse 19, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, the same as Hebron, or Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the sons of Heth. And so Abraham buries his wife in that place. And he moves on. And he realizes more than ever that he is a stranger, a pilgrim, and a sojourner. People sometimes say to me, still to this day, oh, John, I'm so sorry you lost your daughter. And I say, I appreciate your sentiment. Thanks a lot. But you know, I didn't lose her. I know right where she is. I know exactly where she be. She's in heaven. And Abraham would say that day, Machpelah, double door. I know where my wife Sarah is, passing through one door and out the other in eternity. These things are very, very practical. And I leave you with this simple point. I am so glad that we're saved, because I cannot figure out how people would deal with the departure of a child, a spouse, a parent, or whoever. I cannot figure out how people deal with it. What do they think about? What do they do? I guess you go in for therapy and you get a huge, giant big screen TV and you space out hour after hour, or you get drunk, or you smoke pot, or you, I don't know what you do. But how thankful I am for me and you. We know what life is about. The Word makes it real clear. We're sojourners and strangers. He gives us a peace in the meantime that passes understanding. We're headed for heaven. We don't have to let our hearts be troubled. And the unbeliever, or the person that doesn't have a relationship with the Lord, how they must struggle and wonder and be sort of in a daze or a stupor, or refuse to think about the reality of death. Man, how different it is for you and me. And if there's no other reason for being saved, this is a good one. This is a great one. Because you know what life is about, and you know where you're going, and you can say, it all makes sense in the framework of eternity. I'm glad I'm a Christian. I'm real glad I'm saved. Otherwise, I would be scared to death of life. But I'm not, and neither are you, because we understand. We really understand. If you've been saved for a long time, like many of you have been, my prayer is, don't take it for granted, the fact that you understand what life is about. Don't think back, if you possibly can, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, or whenever it was that you were still a pagan, a heathen, an unbeliever. What did you think about when you heard about someone dying? Or when you felt that your life might be in jeopardy? You feel terror. The book of Hebrews says they're in bondage to the fear of death all their days. You're in bondage to the fear of death, not just physical death, but the death of finances or relationships or health or whatever it might be. Always afraid. And then you got saved. then you became a believer. You started walking with the Lord. And everything is framed. Everything is a part of a plan. And you know that it's all going to come together gloriously in heaven. I'm really glad I'm saved. I'm glad you're saved. Even if prayers weren't answered, even if blessings didn't come, if there's nothing else that came my way than this, the understanding of eternity and the fact that we'll be in heaven eternally, I would say, man, what a good deal it is being a Christian. What a great deal. What a fabulous deal. And I'm real glad. Aren't you?